Welcome to the Public Morality. It seems there are so many places one can locate an historical nexus for the current conflict in Israel. From the 19th century European pogroms to the 1948 war and the Declaration of Jewish Independence that ultimately displaced hundreds and thousands of people, to the Six-Day War in 1967 or the collapse of the 2000 Peace Summit at Camp David, there are plenty of data points one can cite, but here we are. The attack on October 7th, 2023, a combination of violence and sexual assault, left more than 1,200 Israelis dead and some 240 hostages taken by Hamas, opened a new wave in the conflict. The Israeli response has led to a Palestinian death toll that has exceeded 30,000 men, women, and children. It leaves the global community with the enduring question, where do we go from here? To begin our conversation, we welcome American University political science professor Boaz Azili to the Public Morality. Professor Boaz Azili, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Too often, at least from my perspective, feels the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians is based largely on the most recent high-profile event. This latest chapter, at least in the public discourse, is based on Hamas's attack on October 7th and the subsequent response by the Israeli government. But it's talked about, in my view, as if there's no history. If you could, how do we, in your view, arrive at the present moment?
Well, that will probably take a very long time because there's a very long history to this conflict. But I'm going to try to make it briefly. So we arrive for this conflict, like the conflict itself is on for the last 150 years, more or less. And it starts in the 19th century. I think in my mind, when the Jewish people kind of jumping on the bandwagon of nationalism, some of the Jewish people decided to think about themselves as a nation, mostly because no other emerging nation in Europe wanted to consider them as part of this. And as a nation, as a people, they saw the country that was then called Palestine as their, or actually it wasn't really called Palestine yet, in the Ottoman, part of the Ottoman Empire, as the natural place to be attached to, because of the history of this land for the Jewish people. At the same time, there's a rise of Arab nationalism, again in the Middle East. If you think about nationalism as a modern movement. So that's where it started. And then we all know it went through a lot of stages. Probably most important is the 1948 war, which or the UN resolution before that war that established two states, one Jewish Israeli, one Arab Palestinian. And the war that ensued, which resulted in the establishment of the State of Israel, but with no establishment of the State of Palestine, which was devastated in the war. Instead, Jordan and Egypt took over the control of some of the territories, and the continuation of the and expansion, really, of the fighting between Israel and its Arab neighbors. The next really important station in that is 1967, where Israel defeated Egypt, Syria, and Jordan in a fight and took over significant territories, including the West Bank and including Gaza Strip. Since then, Israel is controlling, occupying the West Bank, and until 2005, also controlled Gaza Strip. And it went through a lot of other iteration, including in 1993, the Oslo Accords, which were, in my mind, the most serious attempt at really arriving at peace, but an attempt that was not successful to some degree because of Hamas, to some degree because of Jewish settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And that kind of broke in 2000 with the Second Intifada. Important to note the 2005 withdrawal or disengagement of Israel from the Gaza Strip took out Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip, as well as the military, and got out of the Gaza Strip. But then, after Hamas took hold of the Gaza Strip in 2007 and began to shoot rockets in Israel, Israel retaliated, as always, with much more force, and also put a siege on the Gaza Strip, which is still in place almost 20 years later. Again, there's a lot of details in between, but as I said, these are the kind of most important station points in this story.
No, you initially said that it would be difficult, and I understand it certainly is difficult, but I think you did a great job of, and the reason I wanted you to answer that way is simply because everything you just said, in my view, gets left on the table when people talk about, the issue in the moment. So all this history sort of gets left behind, and I think it's important to we unpack the complexity here. You mentioned Hamas. In your perspective, what is the primary identity of Hamas?
The primary identity of, I guess, there are dual identities. In on the one hand, it's a sort of like a national liberation movement for the Palestinian people, and national liberation with a maximal goals, basically to take over the entire Palestinian entire kind of historical Palestine. The other side of Hamas, that it's a very religious fundamental organization that once it takes hold of Palestine, the kind of society and regime it wants to establish is a very strict Muslim society. In which, at least what we kind of can gather from their control of the Gaza Strip, will have very little room for other components in the society. So it's hard to tell at different points in history. There are different weights given to the sort of like national and the religious aspects of Hamas, but both of them are reported to Hamas, and both of them are kind of coalesced into a political goal, which in my mind is at least as important to Hamas as to defeat Israel is to defeat other competing Palestinian parties or organization, in particular the Fatah, which is a secular Palestinian liberation organization.
I asked that because it seems to me that, given your last answer, that historically speaking, the notion that one body can fulfill both the governing responsibilities as well as maintaining itself as a resistance movement that has never panned out. Isn't that what Hamas is trying to do here? Is trying to be both a governing arm and a resistance arm at the same time? And I don't know how you can possibly balance those two.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, and it kind of touch a very important point. So Hamas, it's not kind of completely unique to Hamas, because you can see Hezbollah is trying to do basically the same in Lebanon, and is to be a political party that strives to gain control of the political system, and hence also the governing of Gaza, but at the same time continue with the sort of like ethos of resistance. And when these two collide, time and again, Hamas chooses resistance over governing, and so in their calculation, for example, right now, they see this war so far as a victory. If you look at the governing aspects, the death of more than 30,000 people, the complete destruction of probably by now like 80% of the Gaza Strip. I don't know how you can see that as a victory in any meaningful sense, but in terms of resistance, they see that as a victory, because the result is more political support inside and outside of the Gaza Strip, and I think actually much more outside of the Gaza Strip than inside, but it's very hard to tell. Because like public opinion polls in this situation are not very reliable, but yeah, so that support is something that kind of drives them in terms of the resistance, and their kind of elevate their resistance image. But again, the consequences for the people that they were governing is tremendous. The other aspect also is that for many years we hear, and for good reasons, about the impoverished situation in Gaza and how people in Gaza suffer from the Israeli siege, etc., which is all true and terrible. But also we now kind of know much more than we knew, even like before October 7, that Hamas created at the same time tremendous, it had tremendous investment in creating this whole underworld of tunnels, crisscrossing the Gaza Strip, and the ammunition and rocket. Cachet that is huge, and a lot of money went into this, which could have gone through to things that will be much more helpful for the population in terms of governance.
Is it possible, and I'm speaking strictly now the way America sort of divides the issue, is it possible to be pro-Israel or pro-Palestinian and not factor, let's say, if you're pro-Palestinian and not include October 7th, or if you're pro-Israel, you don't include, the settlements? Can't, I mean, is it? Is that just too simplistic to say I'm pro-Israel, I'm pro-Palestinian without any kind of nuance?
I would say yes. I think that one of the things that are, to me, most saddening in what happened in the this whole discourse about the conflict in the US, but also in many other places in the world since October 7th, is that one sort of like has to choose sides. You're pro-Israel or pro-Palestine. And the camp that used to be in between, which says, I'm pro-peace and I'm both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine, almost disappeared. And for me, it's really sad because the results of this is that, neither the benefits of the people of Israel nor the benefits of the people of Palestine gonna win from that. It just cannot be a zero-sum game. And if it is a zero-sum game, they both gonna lose, but probably the sides that gonna lose more is the weaker side, which is Palestinians. So if you're saying I'm pro-Palestine and still you're supporting a especially if you definitely if you're supporting Hamas's action on October 7, but even if you don't, but you still say you're kind of supporting maximal solution that is, from the river to the sea, by all means, these kind of slogans, it's really nice as slogans, but that means basically that you're not really supporting the people that you think you're supporting, because Palestinians are the weaker side in this conflict, and if it's all or nothing, they're gonna be left with nothing. The same with Israel. Israel is the stronger side in terms of like military might and even economics, etc. But they suffer tremendously from the continuation of this conflict for the foreseeable future, and from all sorts of aspects. And there's just no solution in my mind. If both sides don't recognize that there are two people, two nation, if you will, in this small land, and the recognition of the kind of mutual recognition of both of them is the conditions for which they need to reach some kind of compromise and some kind of solution that will let them live, either side by side or one with each other. The one-state solution, the two-state solution, that's a secondary point to just recognize that there are two people there, and neither of them is going away. And until both of them realize that, they will not be able to live together. Now, I do think that actually majority of people in Israel and in Palestine realize that. It's more people outside of Israel and Palestine that either support Israel or support Palestine that don't realize that.
Well, speaking for those who exist outside of the area, especially here in America, there have been politicians and I would even say some in the media that have equated the situation in Palestine to that of South African apartheid. Is that accurate? If not, why not?
Not quite. I think there are some points of resemblance, but not quite. So I think we need to differentiate here between what I would call Israel proper, that is the area inside the Green Line, the area that is kind of that Israel was territorially before 1967, and the area outside of it. So in Israel proper, so that doesn't include the West Bank, it doesn't include the Gaza Strip, there is a democracy. It's a flawed democracy. It has a lot of problems, and there is definitely discrimination against the minority Arabs slash Palestinians that live there, but they are citizens and they can choose in elections, and they can go to courts, etc. Again, it has a lot of room to improve, And there's actually like a more of that is threatened now, but I would say it's an apartheid per se. Where I do see significant resemblance to apartheid is in the what I call the occupied territories. That's the West Bank, Gaza. It's a different story because Israel until October 7 did not actually control it for 20 years. But the West Bank, in which there are two different legal systems. There's a it's kind of like more complicated because it's officially in terms of international relations, it's an occupied territory rather than a part of a country like South Africa was. But increasingly, because there are many settlements and many settlers, and they have a completely separate and not equal systems, that kind of more resembling an apartheid, and more so in recent years than it used to be the case.
As American public discourse tries to grapple with this issue, my view, I feel that the matter is based on how individuals feel by either about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or how they feel about Hamas. So if I'm pro-Israel, then it's because I hate Hamas. Or if I'm pro-Palestine, I hate Netanyahu. And we're doing more of that and not really looking at the nuance and the people involved on both sides of the equation. Your thoughts, sir?
I think it's much more c complex than that. So I'm not as familiar with the for instance, the Muslim American community, the dynamics in there. But I can tell you that in the Jewish community in Israel, in the US, the picture is much more nuanced than that. Actually, majority of the Jewish community in Israel are sort of like to the left of the center. They most of them vote Democrats, and there's a lot of them, a lot that are really don't support Netanyahu. But they feel that in times of crisis, they need to, protect the tribe, if you will. They feel that they need to stand with Israel because, like, on October 7, they feel like the state of Israel was under brutal attack, which it was. They feel that. That in the discourse that happened after October 7, there is a lot of calls for basically the destruction of Israel or for Israel to cease to exist. And they feel that they need to stand with Israel no matter who is the in control of Israel. And I think a lot of them realize or they don't think that Netanyahu is a good leader. But they still will present that image to the outside world because they think that you can't you do your dirty laundry inside but don't do it outside. I'm guessing that there's some kind of similar dynamic on the other side. Majority of Muslim Americans probably do not do not fear, do not think in the same way that Hamas is, and they are not as militant, but they feel that in order to project an image of pro-Palestine, they need to support that as well. And that's really unfortunate for both sides in my mind because these leaders, these kind of extreme leaders such as Netanyahu and Sinwar and the military leader of Hamas are creating enormous damage to their own people. And in Israel itself, there's now increasingly people that were kind of kept quiet since the start of the war are starting the process to protest. Yesterday, there was 100,000 people in Jerusalem protesting the government and calling Netanyahu to go. And I think that should also be the case in the US. If you think that Netanyahu is only causing damage to Israel, to the Jewish people, to the cause of, for instance, the releasing the hostages, you should say it rather than kind of like stick with your tribe.
Finally, can the is it a scenario in your view where the occupation could cease in a manner that remain consistent with Israel's security needs? In other words, can you have both?
I think yes. I think yes, and there have been proposals throughout the history to do so, different proposals. In the end, I study international relations. In history, no conflict lasted forever, right? If you would tell French and Germans at a certain historical time that they will be not only living side by side peacefully, they will be in many cases collaborating, cooperating in a friendly way, they would think you're crazy. If you would say the same about British and French in a certain at a certain historical time, they would think you're crazy as well. And no conflict lasts forever. And my guess is that this one will not last forever either. Israel and the Palestinians, definitely the current situation of war does not serve the security of either Israel or the Palestinians. And the October 7 was one grim awakening in that sense. You cannot Netanyahu thought that he could kind of manage the conflict, that he could keep Hamas at bay, give them more money through Qatari money, just keep them quiet. And from time to time, hit them militarily, but keep them like that without basically without an engagement with the Palestinians diplomatically. But I think we gave a lot of chance, a lot of credit to war and violence to solve this problem, and it only creates more war and violence. And what we haven't tried for a very long time since the failure of Oslo agreement is to give some peace a chance. And I think in the long run, you have to design peace in a way that kind of creates assurances, etc. But the security of both sides will only be guaranteed through a long-lasting peace. I still think that the two-state solution is much more realistic and likely to succeed than the one-state solution. But if there are reasonable suggestions that take into account the security and survival and guarantee for both sides that they can live in peace together, that's something to be considered as well. The key is to realize that there are two people here, or not here, in that small country that don't go anywhere. They would not go anywhere. and they need to find a solution, and they can find a solution that will work with each other. Right now, I think the most Israelis and most Palestinians, if you could guarantee them that there's going to be a situation in which they can give up some of their land but live in peace and security, if you could guarantee that, they would say yes, I'm willing to go for that. But both sides distrust each other deeply, and they don't think that the other side wants it. They all don't think that the other side will ever agree to that. But if you have a majority of both sides that actually agree to a compromise, so that's a misperception on both sides, that there isn't, a constituency for peace. Finding a way to get there, that's the tricky part.
Professor Blaz sir, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on the Public Morality. I wish we even had more time because it seems like we could spend the next three episodes talking about this very, very complex issue. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Absolutely, and thank you, Byron.
That was Boaz Azili. Stay tuned as we continue our conversation with University of Notre Dame Professor Talia Omar on the Public Morality on WSNC Radio.